Welcome everyone to the roundup. I'm Amanda.
I'm Amanda.
I'm going to read the preamble for Al-Anon. The Al-Anon family groups are a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who share their experience, strength, and hope in order to solve their common problems. We believe alcoholism is a family illness and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. Al-Anon is not allied with any sect, denomination, political entity, organization, or institution. Does not engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. There are no dues for membership. Al-Anon is self-supporting through its own voluntary contributions. Al-Anon has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps, by welcoming and giving comfort to the families of alcoholics, and by giving understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic. Now I'm going to have Jackie read the 12 steps.
Hi everyone, my name is Jacqueline. 12 steps of Al-Anon. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And we've asked John to read our traditions.
Hi, I'm John. 12 traditions. Our common welfare should come first. Personal progress for the greatest number depends upon unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one authority, a loving God. He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the relatives of alcoholics, when gathered together for mutual aid, may call themselves an Al-Anon family group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliation. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting another group or Al-Anon or AA as a whole. 5, each Al-Anon family group has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics. 6, our family groups ought never endorse, finance, or lend our name to any outside enterprise. These problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. Although a separate entity, we should always cooperate with Alcoholics Anonymous. 7, every group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Al-Anon 12-step work should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Our groups, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, the Al-Anon family group have no opinion on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, and TV. We need guard with special care the anonymity of all AA members. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles above personalities.
If you guys can help me welcome Katie from Grover Beach, she's going to speak for us. Good afternoon, everybody. I am sure that the higher power that governs our lives every day is surely with us today. My name is Kay Brewster, and I am a grateful, very grateful, deeply grateful member of Al-Anon. Glad to be asked. I want to thank the members of the committee. I feel alone up here now. Obviously, I must be. Wherever they are, thank you very much for pulling my name out of the hat and asking me to come down and share. This seems like a very intimate group today, and I'm going to highlight my life and my recovery because of the time consideration. So there may be parts of my story that you would like more information on. Please feel free to ask me when I'm done, if you have any interest. I was born into an Irish Catholic family. I am the oldest of three children. I have two younger brothers, a mother and a dad. Our home could be categorized as isolating and controlled. Controlled by an Irish mother who, at her most difficult times in parenting, felt that control was her only answer. And I was one of her children that so desired to connect with members of my family. I wanted to connect with my mother. I've always been a big book person, loved to read, and I can remember as a little girl, there were a picture of a mother and a daughter in matching navy blue coats, walking into the page of the book, holding hands. And I so wanted to hold hands with my mother. I wanted to talk with my mother. My mother shook my hand off when I'd reach for it. Her hand was never available. And then when I wanted to talk with her, she'd say, why don't you go to your room and figure that out. And when you've done that, then come back out and I'll talk to you later. And I'm here today to tell you that you can survive later never coming. So when I got to young adulthood, teenagehood, I believe that it was all up to me. I didn't feel any instruction, any good modeled behavior, except pretending. I can remember pretending we all got in the car to go to church every Sunday. And we pretended to be a family that took the center aisle of the church to the appropriated purchased pew in that church because of donations. And we all showed up for that. And then afterwards we'd return to the car and there would be quiet or chaotic yelling in the car all the way home. So I was taught how to pretend and I took note of that. I had an excellent education. My parents paid for a private education for me, and the Dominican nuns and I never got along. We never saw eye to eye on anything, but I'm forever grateful for the education that I was given from my family. I've been married a few times, and the men were all good men. The traveling problem had my name all over it. I had become boisterous and controlling myself as I
learned to go to work, learned to work for the company store, learned to give my opinion and be prepared for the cost of that opinion. Sometimes I was able to keep the job, other times I was removed from jobs, uttering my opinion on things and how it should go. So there was a lot of filtering out between what I learned as a child and what I was going to bring forward into my life. My first husband, I married out of that. He went to junior college and so did I, but I went there just to find my meal ticket, and he went there to study. And so we got married. I convinced him that I was probably the best deal on campus, and he bought that. He married me, and we started a family. A loving God that I had separated myself from, God went with the church. And when I left the church, I left God. And so now I had these two little children, perfect children, given to a woman that emotionally and spiritually was totally incapable of handling that profound spiritual responsibility called parenting. I put them both in a playpen. I didn't know what to do with them. My husband was working, I was alone, and I felt he was out there having fun at me, and so I'm not proud of the things that I've come down here today to tell you about, but I left those children sometimes in the company of a sitter and sometimes in the company of the power of the universe. It just went out and did whatever I wanted to do and came back, and they were always sleeping close to one another. So obviously, even though I did not recognize a loving God recognized my need and those that suffered from being in my company and took very good care of my two children. I'm moving through this really fast, so bear with me. There came a time in this first marriage where my husband moved us to another part of town. And it was in this neighborhood that he working all the time, me being alone with these two children. I started up a conversation at first, but then it went into an affair with a neighbor in the neighborhood. And it was a gentleman lived by himself. I really didn't know him. I didn't really care to know him, but I just didn't feel lonely that there was somebody that I could count on. And so I had an affair with this man. I did not know at the time that he was a schizoid personality. He was a convict. He was a little bit of, not a little bit, he was a whole bunch of bad boy. And an alcoholic on top of that. So I had an affair. I also was in the process of divorcing my first husband this time. And so that justified it to a point. And so I moved out of the home, moved out of that neighborhood, went to another neighborhood with my children. This gentleman that I'd had this affair with followed me there. And one night, kicked the front door in, drunk, ran up the stairs, and I ran up ahead of him and got ahead of him and stood in the bedroom, in the doorway of my children's bedroom. And he took me by the neck and threw me down the stairs. And the next thing I remember is I was in his car. He had flipped open the glove box, showed me a gun, and said, "I can hear the cops are on their way. When they get here, if you even make one move toward getting out of this car, and they're going to plead to have you do it, if you do it, then I'll come back and kill your children." And I believed him. I was just sick enough now because I was operating on my own. No God, no husband, I'm divorcing him, and this other powerful voice in my life, and I did not get out of the car. I can remember the face to this day of the lady policeman through the windshield, through the glass on the side of the car, pleading with me, make any move to get out of the car, but we cannot come in and get you, and we'll have to leave. And they did. And I was taken in for the next 4 or 5 days. I was almost beat to death in his house. Throwing his gun around, drinking. And it was horrific. I was unconscious a lot, but a lot of it I was very conscious for. I did not know. I don't know how my children got into his home, even to this day. I don't know that. So God has said, I don't need to know him. But they were hiding in a back closet and heard and observed some of what was going on. I was found by a member of my family because I was taken back into that old neighborhood. And when the police kept coming, trying to find me, finally came into that neighborhood. And that's when I was found. I was taken to a local hospital. They turned me away because I was so close to death. They said, you're gonna have to take her to a county hospital in Los Angeles, the big county hospital down there. And the two doctors that saved my life that night told me after, when I was released several weeks later, that they saw a lot of people come in and out of that hospital. And they knew when they jumped on the gurney and straddled me, beginning to do the things that was going to save my life, that I didn't look like the usual patient that was brought in by ambulance. And they just had that feeling, and they were very loving and made sure that I knew that they had that feeling. That was a feeling that I built on early in my recovery, that when we come in where we are convinced and we know from actual truth in our families that we're not heard, that we don't have a voice. Here were two young doctors that helped give me a subtle message that I was worth the effort of their medical care. Those of us that are affected deeply by alcoholism are not dumb. Actually, we're way too smart. We're way too smart. But things befall us in our journey toward fixing things, making our family better, changing what we can. I had all that laid out in front of me as well, but I didn't think anything was wrong with me, even though I was putting together this horrific past. As a result of this with my children, I was taken to court and I was declared an unfit mother. And this was quite an experience. I'm a legitimate senior these days, and I think back about how young I was. I was 36 years old. And I was standing before a judge after a two-week trial took place. And the judge was telling me, I am going to remove your children from you, not because you're bad, but because of your behavior. We have no guarantee that we can count on better behavior from you. And the children will suffer more. So with that, I declare you an unfit mother. And in those years, the only women that were experiencing a situation like this were women that were alcoholics or drug addicts. They were having their children taken away. But I was neither. Now, I professed well into my Al-Anon recovery that there was no mental illness. I couldn't even say the words mental illness because in my family, I had aunts that my family lowered their voice and talked about, and only to find out that they had been put into homes back then because of deep behavioral problems and mental problems. And the family would lower their voice and talk. So I knew that if I said I was mentally ill, that someone would hear it and know it, and then someone would arrive to take me and lock me up. Now I was a grown person, now well into my 40s, but that had been an imprint on me, and that's what I really thought. Not that it would have ever happened, but it was a long time in recovery before I was able to be at peace with saying the words, I am mentally ill, deeply mentally ill. So my children were taken away from me. I returned to Los Angeles. I went for a while and stayed with my mother while I continued to recuperate. And then I wanted to come back to LA. Came back to LA, moved into an apartment house, the first 30 days paid by my family. That's all they would pay. I was fortunate. I was really fortunate. They had every right to say, go to the Salvation Army. Go somewhere where somebody will help you. We don't know how to help you. I was an embarrassment to the family. I had harmed members of the family. And this is not what their name wanted to go along with an adult child like me. So I went into his apartment house, and it was here that I was going to meet the second gentleman that was going to pay my way, and I found him. He read, I noticed that he'd come to the pool and read. I liked that part of it. He was very tan, so obviously that looked well, a very handsome man. I never had a problem in the look choice. I always did quite well, fortunately. But I was the problem, and where I went, trouble went. And he had a little cooler, and he poured himself a drink down by the pool. So the next thing I know, I'm on my way to Las Vegas to marry him. We had quite a period of togetherness where he would call me. He was a salesman on the road a lot, and he'd go and meet with his client, and then they'd go out to dinner and they'd drink, and then everybody would leave, and he'd be so drunk he couldn't find the car. And he'd maybe be in San Luis Obispo, and he'd call me in Los Angeles in the middle of the night and say three very important words back then for me, and they were, I need you. Out of my own mouth, I was not admitting to how needy I was. But I placed all my eggs in outside circumstances. If I could control the outside circumstances, clean them up, tidy them up, and help you in any way, then that's where I wanted to be. There was no possibility that I was going to turn that spotlight on myself and without a handout. So this marriage was doomed to failure as well. However, I bargained with God along the way. I called God back in for a passage. Did anybody give me this? No, okay. Came back in, and he came back in because I was pleading. I was pleading with him to give me one more chance to be a better mother. Well, bottom line, that's an insane thought. And it's insane because nothing was changing with this mother that was pleading for another perfect baby. But a loving God, who's always on standby, said, of course. And I had a little baby girl. Now I had three girls. And so she was born, and I was ready to pack my bags and get out. I was on the run again. Now what I have learned about me over a long period of time, long period of time, is that you can't run away from yourself. I could not run away from the pain, the fear, the lies. I couldn't run far enough or fast enough to separate myself from my truth. And I had never heard it put that way up to that point, and I did never hear it again until I was in Al-Anon. When people were talking about the courage that is required to speak our own truth, speak what we know to be true about ourselves. And without a secure community, women that kept their words and came to meetings. When they said they were glad to see me, I began to believe that maybe in a way they were glad to see me. It was a safe community for me. And that's when I began to hear that you will learn how to tell what you know about yourself. So after that, this marriage went down the drain as well. Now I want to tell you a little bit about how I was brought to Al-Anon. I thought I was losing my mind. I should have, based upon my behavior. And so I thought I'd go to a painting plaster in Paris, like an adult education community. I thought that would help me focus and calm down, settle down. And so I went to this, and this day there was another woman that was trying to find a class as well. She was drunk, I was not. Neither one of us could find the right corridor, and there were only about five that made up this little school. And that's how crazed and insane we both were that day. However, God prevailed, and she asked me to go to lunch with her. And I hadn't been out and around, and I said, that sounds nice. She said, I'll pay for it. That even sounded better. And so we went to a bar. We walked into this bar, and we walked straight through the back to a back lounge in the corner. I want to tell you about the strip center where this bar was located. It was just one straight line of buildings. On the very end was a funeral home. On the building next to the bar where we were was a gun shop. And on the other side of the bar was the Greyhound bus station. God has never wiped that from my memory. I think it's very important that I see it still. That is where my first real surrender was going to take place. Judy and I sat in the back of that bar, and she told me her story, and it was sad, and I cried. And then she said, what about you? And I didn't know what to tell her. Certainly, I didn't know my truth yet. I wasn't anywhere near that. So I lied. I wrote a story. It must have been sad because she cried too, not because she had too much to drink, I'm sure, but because that's what we did. We left the bar, and I was not to see her until quite a while after. And by this time, I was about 5'7" in height, and I weighed about 85 pounds. I was not eating. I was not sleeping. I wasn't taking care of my personal things regarding myself that were mine to take care of. And I ran to the grocery store this one night from my house across the boulevard to a grocery, barefoot. I had long, long hair. I just was a mess inside and out. When this grocery store, and who should I see there that night? But Judy, the woman that I had gone to lunch with. And somehow when I saw her, it terrified me. And it terrified me because she was all just white. There was just a lot of white, bright light around her. And all I can remember her saying wasn't much because I wasn't listening. I was absolutely hyperventilating about how I was going to get away. I had to get away from her. But I saw her mouth moving, but I did hear her say, one of these days I'll come by. Don't you live around here somewhere? And she had found me. Now, what had happened to her between our lunch and this night at the grocery store, she had gotten sober. She was newly sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was on fire with sobriety. And she wanted to come and find somebody that she could help. And she chose me. And I want to believe that that was spiritually intended. I'm not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a straight-up Al-Anon member. But I was brought to Al-Anon by a new person, a new sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had heard her call, and she came and found me. That could have not happened but it did happen. She brought me to my first meeting. I wasn't overly impressed with my first meeting. The place, the curtain was kind of hanging off funny on the other side of the main window. We walked in, everybody was talking, nobody was listening, everybody was smoking. And I thought, where have you brought me? And this was an Alano club down in Los Angeles and had a lot of traffic in the front door, out the back, over the pool tables. I mean, there was just a whole lot of activity going on. And but there was also a meeting, an Al-Anon meeting going on. And so we went in. And it seemed like everybody was not as old as I am today, however close. And I asked one of the women, I said, where do the younger women like me go? Where do the people that have more education? I was arrogant enough to let that come out my mouth. And this woman was kind enough to say, you know, this is the Al-Anon meeting here on Monday night at 8:30. We had all attend this meeting. And I said, oh, that's nice. But I could not wait to get out of there. I just thought, this is not going to work for me. Well, one thing that I had not considered, that I could get things and I could clutch and hold on to them, but they were not mine. I got all that to try and alter how I felt, but none of that was going to stick with me. I was lonely. I was desperately lonely. I had not connected from being a little girl, and I tried to with husbands. I tried to with jobs. I was employable, employed, made lots of money, made no difference at all. Nothing has changed from outside in. From inside out, the change is manifested. That's where a loving God's transformative power is seen. What he can do from inside out with just a little openness on our part. So I went back to that meeting. I thought, I'll try it again. And now I'm going to skip ahead again. One night I came in late. Oh, 5 minutes. Thank you, honey. Thank you. And I came in late, and this woman asked me how I was, and I said, I was just fine, thank you. And she said, you're a liar. That woman became my first sponsor. And I didn't like her much that night, and it took me quite a while before I really did like her, realizing that she was carrying a message that I needed to pay attention to. And a slow, loving, soft-pedaled message was not going to get it to me. I needed to be jarred into becoming present at that moment. And years ago, and I'll tell you now that this year I celebrated a magnificent recovery birthday. I celebrated 50 years in Al-Anon. I didn't think I was going to live to be beyond 50 years old, let alone consciously choose to stay in a recovery program that was so far beyond my rationale, my rational thinking, that anything could change or would change for me. It's just a miracle, an absolute miracle. Sponsorship has worked and worked very well for me. I've needed a hand up since my mother shook my hand off. I needed a connection. Connection for me is an exceedingly important word, an action. And you know, choosing to recovery is an action that we take. You know, we are blessed with the option to get better, to do better with our lives. But the action that is going to pay off is one that we choose to make. I have been influenced by the women that I go to meetings with from the very beginning. I took my seat. They told me that I couldn't see that my name was carved in the seat, but they expected every night to see me in a chair with my name on it. And I don't know why I believe this fantasy stuff, but they were handing it to me left and right. And they saw a woman that was so far separated from her true self that they just couldn't go wrong in telling me some of the stuff that was just outrageous. You know, this will happen to you. You will become a miracle. You will come to the meeting tomorrow night because you'll feel that loneliness seeping in on you again. So we'll be here. And they always were. And I just wondered where all this stuff came from. So I have been sponsored. I've had three sponsors in my recovery. They all have been magnificent help to me. Like I said, I have surrendered to needing a hand up every day. I was told if you're in trouble every day, you need a hand up every day. That means that you make an outreach call, that you go to a meeting. You do not stay home and think about how bad you feel. You know, I lived a life of blame. I blamed everybody for situations that I got myself into. And then I carved those people out. I thought, oh, well, I can fix this. I'll carve them out. And then when I carved them out, I was worse than I felt before I started any of that action. That's what a sick mind will do over and over again. Okay, because I'm out of town, I am out of town, but I also asked the girls at the head table here to keep me abreast of time. And I wrote down a few things today. I don't usually bring those to the podium, but I did today. But I wanted to, because I am working on my recovery legacy now, and I still go to lots of meetings. I still do service in Al-Anon. I take calls. I'm on the phone a lot. I have a lot to repay others who are in a state of confusion, a state of just like, I know it all. And it's what we're willing to unknow and still continue to stay that has given my life meaning today. I'm still learning to talk about the truth that I know about myself, even after all these years. For some of us, it takes a long, long time. What are my spiritual practices? Prayer, meditation, affirmation, creative visualization. All of that works for me now. I was told that to address a power greater than myself would be part of my spiritual purpose. My spiritual purpose today is any and all things that are above me. And I look for that. I look for that everywhere. So, let's see, what does this one say? I had free will for a long, long time. Ran with it. Tripped me up, tied knots. I hung myself by free will. Today I know that I am free to have a relationship with a power greater than myself, an easy relationship. I don't have to go to a special building, take a special body position to connect with my higher power. My higher power is no longer a distant possibility. The power is an inner reality, a presence that is with me every day. And for that, I am deeply grateful that I learned that. My prayer to close today, now I'm sure I'm past closing, is that I have recognized that my higher power is my teacher continuously. That my higher power is sets the topic for the lesson plan this day. And all that my higher power asks of me through the third step prayer, not to turn my will and my life over to him every moment of the day. Impossible to do that for most of us. But what is not impossible is to lean in to willingness. My loving God wants to hear from me every day, wants to help me take an action contrary to what I might want to take. And in doing that, I am leaving the result of my surrender to him. And I live a rich and glorious life. I'm delighted to have come down here today and share a little bit of my story. Thank you very much.
Let's thank her again.